Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest episode of the OES podcast. I am Hassan Muslimani, and I'm head of carbon management research here at the Institute. And I'm joined today by Hannah Haumann, who is global head of carbon trading at Trafic World. Today, we'll be discussing Hannah's recent publication with OES, which is entitled The Creation of a Global Carbon Market, a Taxonomy of Carbon Pricing under Article 6. The article was published on our website in October 2023, and we're recording this on the afternoon of November the 2nd, where we will be going through an overview of the research and its conclusions. Hannah, thanks for joining us today, and welcome to the OES podcast series.
Thanks so much, Hassan. Pleasure to be speaking with you.
Hannah, let's start with a very simple question of what is carbon pricing and why should we care?
Carbon pricing is quite simply a way to value the externality of carbon emissions associated with a particular type of sector or activity. This price signal is ultimately what enables capital to go into new investments and underpin behavior changes within direct activities. And if we think about what markets do best, it's really about how do we translate capital into the goods and services that are required in a reliable and an efficient way. So not dissimilar to any other commodity market on the planet, we're really providing that incentive for production and incentive for action from the private sector, which is ultimately required for emission reductions towards net zero.
So what does that look like in practice? What does carbon pricing look like in practice?
So there are three, let's say, main categories or buckets that we see. These would be called penalties, subsidies, or valuations of carbon sinks. So a penalty is exactly what it sounds like. We are penalizing with a price, a positive emission, which is generally associated with industrial activity. Alternatively, we can look at subsidies. So these are, again, very, very intuitively subsidizing what is otherwise not business as usual practices. And then finally, valuations of carbon sinks. So these are activities that, quite frankly, their only economic value can be derived by that externality of carbon emissions. So how do we incentivize those activities when there is no other, let's say, economic justification, unless it's via carbon pricing? So even within this, again, there's a very broad realm within those three categories. But to give a couple examples, within the penalty sphere, we see markets like the European regulatory market. We see subsidies in the form of biofuel subsidies or hydrogen subsidies. And equally, we see valuation of carbon sinks in the form of credits like direct air capture or even conservation of forests.
So when we're talking about, say, a European emission trading scheme, where does that fall? Is that a penalty? I see it as a penalty and both as a subsidy, depending on how you perform. Is the stick and a carrot, is it not?
So that's a great point, because in truth, while we would probably describe EU generally as a penalty, as it's, let's say, penalizing those positive emissions, in reality, you actually get rewarded if you are a more efficient installation. Depending on which end of the spectrum you're operating on in terms of efficiency within Europe, you might be seeing that stick, but equally, you could actually be seeing that carrot if you are outperforming your peers in the sector. And it can also be a revenue generator within that market pricing.
It's very interesting. So what do you think determines the success of any of these carbon pricing mechanisms based on previous and current, you know, experiences? Do you think either of those is more effective than the other?
So I don't think there's necessarily a one size fits all. And I think that's the common conclusion and you know, what people would love to gravitate to is, okay, what's the simple carbon price? What is the simple carbon unit? What is a simple type of mechanism? But in reality, we need as many carbon markets as we do have kind of sources of emissions to be able to tackle each of these very individualized problem sets. So when we're thinking about is something successful or not, I think what we're really trying to look at is, one, did we see behavior change? Did something occur that otherwise would not have happened without the valuation of this externality? And typically that's looked at as, was capital invested? But more specifically, and the ultimate goal here is, were emissions actually reduced? So there is no kind of singular form that is quote unquote right or wrong. And equally, this changes over time. But we have seen, I think, the efficacy of these markets over time, such as in Europe, which is the longest standing regulatory market, which because of its carbon policies has actually seen a 47% reduction in emissions since 2008 in the power sector alone. So we know that these markets can work and be extremely effective. And again, delivering those intended outcomes, which is, yes, behavior change, capital allocation to emission reduction and removals, but very importantly, the ultimate goal of actually reducing the total emissions.
That's very interesting. And I have way too many questions here, but I will start with, and it's a natural segue to what you were saying. So who determines what a carbon pricing mechanism is, or the specifications of a carbon pricing mechanism?
So this is always a loaded one, but I think this calls back to that point before of what exactly are the intended outcomes? So when we are thinking about carbon pricing, which is the valuation of externalities, the buyer is the one ultimately deeming those specifications for delivery of that good. And that's really, again, focused on what are their intended outcomes. So a buyer in that instance can be a regulator that's really seeking to look to decarbonize a power sector, which requires, you know, a certain type of scheme. It can be a sovereign seeking to meet Paris Agreement goals. We can be looking at a corporate seeking to comply with their local compliance regimes. Or equally, we can see a corporate seeking voluntary carbon finance incentives. But ultimately, again, it is down to what is the buyer seeking to achieve? Where are they looking to target capital? And what specifications are they deeming to allow that capital to actually translate into those activities that are producing those emission reductions or removals?
So that seems like it splits the buyers into two, into compliance and voluntary is the way I'm seeing it, or a regulator, right? So from a regulator's point of view, what considerations are taking into account when it comes to the specification of the carbon pricing mechanism?
So indeed, you can imagine that a regulator's viewpoint is as varied as the countries in which they sit. But to break it down into, let's say, more broad categorizations, what we typically see from a regulator is a focus on five key areas. So one is a sectoral approach. So this is either, let's say, low-hanging fruit in terms of what are easy to decarbonize spaces. So I mentioned the power sector before, because typically this is one of the easiest to decarbonize by a fuel switch. So these are very, very good markets and sectors to approach for penalties or subsidies. But equally, we look at things like the natural ecosystems that are in play. So a government that is looking in its backyard and seeing tremendous potential for either conservation of forest or restoration of degraded lands might view policy and approach very differently to someone who is sitting on largely desertic landscapes that actually have high potential for geologic storage of sequestered CO2. So we're working with the natural landscapes and what those opportunities bring. The third piece then is price targets or equally sensitivities. So sometimes governments are really targeting a high enough price to be able to enable that decarbonization. Equally, governments want the ability to put the brakes on price at times to be able to manage any kind of economic impact that this could have on industry. So price is always a key point of focus for a regulator in some scope. The fourth then would be indigenous communities. And we're seeing this especially in the last 5 years as governments are really looking to target carbon finance and ensure that they are protecting indigenous communities and collective landscapes. And then finally, let's call it a temporal consideration, or very simply said, trajectory. So what we need in the year 2025 is vastly different than what we will need in 2045. So how governments are drawing this line between now and net zero at 2050, these are all going to have very different curves, and we're going to require different types of policies and different levels of abatement depending on how we move through time. And again, governments will look at that temporal aspect of the problem in slightly different ways depending on their own unique situations and circumstances.
Very, and very interesting. And where do you see the voluntary buyers sitting in this landscape?
Voluntary buyers are corporates that are, in essence, not covered by a regulatory scheme. So they are volunteering to contribute to carbon finance for some specified aim. So what we generally see is that this is for a differentiated marketing or branding of products, such as carbon neutral products, for example. Sometimes it's actually to enable their customers to be able to contribute to climate finance. So I'm sure you've seen recently on, you know, when you've ordered something online and you have the option to offset your delivery emissions, that ability to plug that in for their consumers, but equally to look at, I think, managing their overall net zero exposure and trajectory. So specifically for those hard to abate emissions. So a lot of corporates are really engaging with the voluntary carbon markets, thinking about how external climate action can be paired with their in-house decarbonization efforts to really ensure they can meet that net zero requirement. So that said, it's worthwhile stating that this is a space that is very rapidly evolving right now in the eyes of the public, in the eyes of the regulator, as well as, let's say, general opinion, as regulators are increasingly treating things like carbon neutral and net zero as investor claims. So that's been a very hot topic for this year and will continue to evolve. But in reality, these voluntary buyers are increasingly turning in to this kind of quasi-compliance type buyer.
I'll have a couple of more questions on the voluntary bit, but I'll come to them in a bit. This is very interesting. But before then, I want to move into the specifications of the carbon unit itself, whether it's emission reduction or removal. What defines that carbon unit? What makes it what it is?
So if we think about other commodities like oil and refined products, we generally categorize products by key specifications or attributes for efficacy. So in oil, this looks like things like density, sulfur, pour point, flash point. When it comes to carbon, we're really thinking about four key features which determine eligibility into various markets. So these are registry, country of origin, methodology, as well as vintage. Registries we can think of as a central bank. So they are the guarantor or the governance of the unit itself. They are publishing what the rules are to be able to apply. They're issuing units, managing the distribution of units, and ultimately the retirement from the system. Registries can be regulated or they can also be voluntary. The second is country of origin. And this is important because we see regulators prioritizing some countries of origin over others. We see voluntary buyers similarly looking at different countries with different preferences based on areas of operation or equally areas where their customers are present. So this is really a key feature and one of the dominant features we see. Equally, methodology, and that's an elongated word for really just describing the type. So what is the type of activity or sector that we are looking to promote? And what is the scientific protocol that one must follow and be able to file and register for to be able to be approved under that particular scheme? And finally, vintage, which is not present in all schemes, but where it is extremely relevant. It is effectively the timestamp of when that emission reduction or removal was recorded.
I would like to pick your brain on registries. Do you think they can ultimately converge into one, or at least have a mechanism by which they can be transferred between one and another?
So I think these are two very distinct questions, in fact. So I'm going to break them into two. So on one, I don't think they should converge, in fact. So we want to see registries pioneering their own specialist methodologies in progress. So we see in the voluntary markets, like the Verified Carbon Standard or VERA, we see Gold Standard, we see Plan Vivo. These all have their very individual specialities and characteristics. Similarly, we see governments with vastly different priorities based on their direct opportunities in country. So the Chinese compliance registry actually has a methodology for bamboo afforestation. That's probably not a natural methodology for the Australian government, for example, to employ, whereas they are mostly looking at things like agricultural land management. So individualized registry is actually a strength of the system, as it enables greater speciality into the individual aspects of the science that deem those methodologies and those protocols. The second part of your question, however, is on, let's say, the tracking or the ability to transfer into these registries. So this today is observed in terms of, I would say, the governance and the checks and balances across the various registries to ensure that projects in tons cannot be double counted and cannot be double issued. But I think moreover to the point of, with all of these various registries, how do we ensure, I think, a like for like or a minimum quality approach? And that's what we are seeing in terms of governance bodies, not just from the regulatory side, but equally from the voluntary side, with initiatives like the ICVCM and the VCMI, which in effect are independent governance bodies that are looking across all of the registries and ensuring a minimum standard of quality, despite the disparity in terms of methodologies based on their level of speciality.
So you've mentioned one of the aspects, which is vintage year. And a lot of the voluntary buyers that I speak to, corporations, they want to not purchase credits that have not been issued in the past 5 years or so. And I guess this is where the industry is moving, perhaps because that means that those credits that were issued before that time were not subject to the same quality requirements that we need today. So my question is, how do you see this affecting demand and supply and obviously price eventually?
So we observe this not just within the voluntary space, but also within the compliance space, where there are restrictions on what the age is of credits that you can deliver. Sometimes this is simply for time barring requirements. So within a regulatory scheme, you might have a 3-year trail or a 5-year trail, or even a project start date defining characteristic, as we see in the airline, the global airline compliance scheme that requires only projects that have been registered after the year 2016. So sometimes this is more for time allocation, but I think there's also a general consideration that the science is constantly improving. In theory, the methodologies each year get better and better and more accurate in terms of actually assessing that emission reduction or removal. And this is why we see a greater preference, I would say, to newer vintages, because one, it is closer to the time period in which the actual offsetting emission was created. But equally, we hopefully are also having the best in class science and the best available measurement to really ensure that quality standard of the ton.
Okay, so to address the elephant in the room, what are the different types of carbon units and how do they differ in scale and cost?
So this is the big question. And indeed, I think we could probably speak for an hour just on these varying types. But I think to put it simply, we see as many carbon methodologies as we do for sources of emissions. So this is naturally highly varied. And you know, we require very different things for a hydrogen subsidy versus what we do for a power sector penalty. So if we look across the world at the varying types, we see everything from conservation of forest projects within REDD+. We see subsidies for improved land management within the agricultural space. We see forestry incentives in New Zealand. We see renewable power subsidies in India. So these are all hugely varied and highly diverse in terms of what they're really trying to achieve. And again, going back to that initial point on what are the intended outcomes and where are we really trying to target capital into those various activities and sectors?
I guess this sort of already answers the question that I already had in mind. And that is, we hear a lot of calls for having, from carbon pricing advocates, for having a single global carbon price, claiming that, you know, such disintegrated carbon markets across different regions with different carbon price levels may be ineffective. What do you say to that? How realistic is having a global carbon price?
A global carbon price is, I think, useful for international collaboration and general ambition. So it's a great idea in theory, but it really kind of falls apart in practice. It is oversimplifying what is actually a very complex problem and very complex issue. So I think a different way to think about this is instead the concept of a global carbon market, which is in effect actually what we're going to be seeing with Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. So not necessarily a singular price or penalty, as every country has had a very different role to play in terms of its contribution to the current climate crisis, as well as its ability to pay for it. So instead of thinking about things as let's say, a global floor or a global penalty, I think it's more appropriate to look at this as a global market, where there are some, let's say, advantaged sources of production. And as with any other commodity market, we want to incentivize the least cost of production. And as price moves up, we're able to actually deliver more production against that particular price signal. So that said, again, while global carbon markets versus a global carbon price is a more appropriate way of thinking about this, even within that global carbon market, we need different solutions for different problem sets. So again, moving away from this concept of one size fits all, as in 2025, we need vastly different solutions than we need in 2045. Hydrogen investments look vastly different to forest conservation. And again, these units need to be segregated and really thought about as an asset class over an individualized product.
So how do you see Article 6 playing out with all of this happening? Is it going to add to the complexity of carbon markets? Is it going to help create a global carbon market? What do you see?
So while I would love to say that there was a panacea for carbon, and in fact, for climate change in general, the reality is that Article 6 will only add to this complexity, but it is effectively creating the foundations for the global carbon market. So Article 6 of the Paris Agreement is the global provision that actually enables countries to trade against their commitments to Paris. So back to that concept of global market versus necessarily global price. What we're seeing is that countries are really approaching this as a measure of increasing their ambition of developing trade and delivering climate finance against other goals of the energy transition, including just transition, especially for the global south. But it's, again, looking at how we can use that pricing signal to incentivize emission reductions and removals at the least cost based on individual advantage economics. So if we think about what Article 6 has the potential to do in terms of changing global markets, it's again, a stratification and an additional heterogeneity that wasn't necessarily in place before. However, what it does do is create this kind of solid foundation that the voluntary market can now look to, that individual regulated markets can now import from, and that equally sovereign buyers can connect with each other to deliver against not only, climate aims, but also climate finance.
So with COP28 coming up, what do you expect to happen, or at least what do you hope for happening?
It's an exciting time, and I think already we're hearing lots of murmurs from sovereigns, as I would say the Article 6 G2G market has already in truth begun. So I think about every other week at the moment, we're seeing either a new export law legislation or a new MOU being signed between nations, as we're really going through the initial frameworks of the architecture of this global carbon market. So as we look to COP28, I think a big hallmark is going to be the establishment of the types and those methodologies that we discussed previously that will be allowed by the UNFCCC, which is the registry for the global Article 6 market. So we're now actually deeming the specifications that can be used for this global compliance market. And over the next 2 years, we will increasingly see that infrastructure being built out, not just on a global trading basis, but also on an individualized country basis that can now really leverage the private sector to put capital to work in a very significant way. So it's an extremely exciting time. There's still a long way to go and a lot of parties in the room to get to a strong agreement. But I think the signs have all been very positive so far. And in reality, we're now moving into the stage of how do we operate this and how do we really manage the governance versus necessarily, agreeing on the intent to begin with, which was established at COP26.
Hannah, this is such an interesting topic. I could definitely talk to you about this for ages. I thank you very much for your time today, for taking us through the nuances of carbon pricing, and most of all, for your great article contribution. For the benefit of our listeners, and as I mentioned earlier, the paper is on our website, so do look out for it. The title, again, is The Creation of a Global Carbon Market, a Taxonomy of Carbon Pricing under Article 6. With that, I would also like to thank you for listening in today. I'd like to mention that as part of the carbon management research, which we are doing here at the Institute, we're looking closely at carbon markets, both compliance and voluntary, and their implementation in different regions. So do keep an eye out for our publications. And as always, we welcome your feedback, and we look forward to having you on future episodes of the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.